You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
It's startling to remember now that in the days following the September 11th attacks, there were barriers all along Canal Street, and the whole area south of it was cordoned off. When WNYC became homeless as a result and our show was being broadcast out of WKCR for about a month, we invited restaurateurs from the downtown area, Drew Naporant and Karen Waltuck, to travel all the way up to Columbia University's campus to speak with us about the impact of the situation on the businesses. And in a separate segment, we talked with Michael LaMonaco, who'd been the chef at Windows in the World. We thought it was important to invite Drew and Michael back to our show today, and they're joined now by David Boulay, whose restaurant Boulay Bakery became an important base of operations for ground relief operators. Michael is now the executive chef and partner at Porterhouse New York. Drew's restaurants include Tribeca Grill, Nobu, Corton, and Centrico. And David operates Boulay Restaurant, Brushstroke, Boulay Bakery, and Market. Welcome to our show. Have I left out any restaurants?
We're feeding a lot of people.
Does it now feel like very long ago to you all?
No. it's an official period of time that's passed. I think 10 years is certainly a very poignant period of time to look back and consider.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember some things about that time that others don't bring up? I know in the case of people who had businesses down there, what they remember most is they feared that they were going to go out of business.
Yeah, I think there was a tremendous amount of uncertainty. And at the same time, it was an extraordinary moment in the history of this city based on the acts of these gentlemen. Obviously, Michael's situation was more dire than almost anyone's. You know, fate was played
spared
a huge
me.
Part in his life.
Well, Michael, you lost your business because you were in the World Trade Towers. I'm sure you're tired of talking about it, but could you just give us a brief synopsis of the story?
Well, just the sheer the will of fate had it that on that morning, you know, there were, Windows on the World was located on the 106th, 107th floor. There were 450 employees who worked there 7 days a week, really round the clock.
It was one of the most successful restaurants in the world, wasn't it?
It really was. At $37 million a year in sales in 2001 dollars. And also, actually, it was very affordable. It had a very low check average. When we talk about check averages, it really served hundreds of thousands of people a year.
I had spoken to Joe Baum, who created the restaurant, and he told me that people said he was crazy for even thinking of having a restaurant 100 stories up in a neighborhood that emptied out at night. And then when the place did that kind of business, everybody said, well, what do you expect? Great location.
And Joe was a genius.
Well, in the building also, Joe had on the lower level something called the Big Kitchen, which was probably copied now a million times around the country. And then they also had the Market Bar and dining, where menu they had the purveyors' names.
Yep.
And that was very innovative.
And Michael, you were in the lower level when the plane hit?
Well, yes. And one other thing just to say, what Drew was just mentioning was in the early days. But, you know, 2001 was the 25th anniversary of Windows on the World. That was the 25th anniversary year. In fact, Veuve Clicquot did a special champagne bottling for us that year. But I was in the concourse level, the shopping level, because when I came in that morning, it was early, 8 o'clock, 8:05, and rather than going to my office on the 106th floor, I went into, you know, this is the story that is that saved my life, is that I walked into an eyeglass shop to have my reading glasses repaired. Really, it was that simple. I was trying to save some time, get them fixed before the day grew long.
And that was a spur-of-the-moment decision?
Spur-of-the-moment. Completely. You know what? It was primary day, you remember. And there wasn't a lot of traffic in the street. It was very easy to get to work. And even the mall traffic was kind of light that morning. So that's what drew me into that store. As I walked by it, I said, let me get them fixed now. And that's where I was when the first plane struck Tower 1, North Tower. That's where Windows was
and
located.
Then you went outside.
Watched the
your whole
horrific
staff?
The whole, you know, that morning there were 79 Windows on the World employees working that morning. So really, in a matter of hours, there would have been three times that many people at work, probably. And there were also people in a private party, and there were people in the breakfast club having breakfast that morning. There were more than 100 people in a private breakfast that morning. It was quite a full occupation. You mentioned that I lost the restaurant. I was the chef director of the restaurant, but, you know, hundreds of people at Windows lost their job. And it, not only did, you know, did we lose 79 people, but the business, as so many businesses in the world, in the Two Towers, really disappeared on that day.
David, I had almost forgotten about the barriers along Canal Street until someone mentioned them recently. And I was talking yesterday with somebody who had analyzed the dust about the odd odors that lingered for quite a while.
Right.
What was it like for you down there?
For us, we had photographs where the dust went to the middle of Duane Street. It looked like it was plowed evenly. It went up directly in the middle all the way across that area. So all the dust went into our air conditioning, into the restaurants, and a lot of the windows broke because a lot of shaking.
How many restaurants did you have at that time?
We had three on that block. But the barrier was interesting. You know, I wasn't there the weekend. I was doing a wedding in France, in the south of France. I was able to get the first flight out to Montreal, and I had a car waiting for me. I pushed the gas pedal to the floor and kept it there until I got to Manhattan. And then the captain of the police department, who was a friend, took me into the Ground Zero. And I remember the military was just moving in at that point. But I met Chief Hall, who was responsible for everything, the fire chief. And the policeman and the fire chief said, we have to have a place to eat. And so we cleaned out one with a hose. And inside those buildings, right on the block, was about 3 feet of dust. So we washed it all with fire hoses. And then he said, we need a hospital there. So, David, do the next one. So we cleaned the next one. And we thought, you know, I went into that thing and I was just going to do a couple meals. And what happened was we did...
Did you think you were going to have any customers?
Well, there was thousands of men sitting on steel everywhere. And they looked really unhappy and they were trying to eat cold sandwiches or something. So it wasn't a customers. We did it on our own for 3 weeks. It was total charity. But the... when we opened, the line went all the way up to Church Street. So it went five blocks. And as we went back and forth for food, after 3 or 4 hours, 5 hours, I went back to talk to my whole staff, which we had 150 people. And I said, doesn't look like I'm going to be able to stop this thing. They're still waiting to eat, because by the time we fed everyone, they were ready to eat another meal. So the first day we did 4,000. The second day we did 16,000 meals.
16,000?
Yep. So it grew that way. But to answer your question, that barrier was, there was a civil barrier and then there was the dust barrier. Mm. And it was a strange time because in Ground Zero was a different world. But if you went up to like 14th Street, we used to go get vegetables, people were going on with their life, which they should have. But then you went back to Ground Zero, you felt like a soldier going to combat.
Yeah, it was unbelievable when you would drive out. We were closed. I mean, it was closed first from 14th Street down.
How many restaurants did you have at that time, Drew?
Six, I think.
All downtown.
Yeah. I mean, what was incredible, you know, of course, 26 years ago, David and I started Montrachet together. So what was incredible on the day after was the Red Cross obviously was going to try to do their thing, but I saw on corners cans of food. It was ridiculous. How do you eat out of a can?
People were just leaving cans of food?
Like piles of it.
Yeah,
so,
it was a surprise.
So, you know, in our case, at Tribeca Grill, my chef, you know, everyone mobilized in their own way, but eventually my chef had called, Don Pintabona called the Spirit Cruise Lines, and those people donated an entire cruise ship. And so they were feeding on the opposite side of the world financial thousands of people. Yeah. And then it was maybe 4 or 5 days into it, I heard about what he was doing. So I went over to, and we weren't exactly talking that much at the time, but we sort of rekindled whatever we had because he was so generous and charitable with what he was doing.
And it's wonderful. We've told the story in the past about the problems you had at one point, but it's obvious now that you've gotten past that. In fact, it was wonderful, my staff tells me, seeing all of you embrace in the ready room while you were waiting to come on. So I guess to some degree, this is something that allowed all of you to bond.
It really did. I honestly believe that, you know, I had to see it for myself in kind of a way, but what David did, and, you know, it was really selfless. And then Michael got people like Waldy Maloof and who are the some
Tom,
of the other?
Tom Valenti. And
Tom Valenti, of course.
These are all some of the most famous chefs of New York.
Exactly.
So and the whole restaurant community, obviously.
The restaurant community really gathered around the windows when people realized, of course, there was a restaurant and there were hundreds of restaurant workers who were affected by this, and not to mention the families of those who were lost. And Windows of Hope was born out of this. And, you know, within a month, on October 11th, we had organized with the restaurant world, with the hospitality world, you know, really thousands of restaurants, but particularly the New York restaurateurs gathered around, and we had our fundraiser, and we raised quite a bit of money on that first day.
Well, did you feel uncomfortable going down to that neighborhood under the circumstances?
You know, I was drawn down there just countless times in the first few years, but particularly in the first year, I was really down there a lot. And in fact, down just when I could get, you know, when they kind of opened the streets again. But within the first few days, I was down in another kitchen. There was another restaurant that was trying to set up a feeding service, and so I went with a group of people from my own team, and we got into a place on Canal Street and started to help them get some cooking going too. So,
could you have imagined opening another restaurant in the neighborhood, or would that have been too painful?
Well, the story that has never been told is that Drew invited me to do that with him, very graciously and generously. Really, within days, within weeks, we were talking, and Drew and I have been friends for decades. And he said, "You know what? I have a spot. It's ready to go. Let's get your team and let's open." And you know, I think at that time, really in the moment was really taken with trying to keep the Windows family together, trying to reconstruct what had happened and try to find out who we'd lost, because that actually took weeks. All of the record keeping was gone, and it took weeks to figure out, you know, what do we do next and how do we do it. And as Drew mentioned, one of the things that we did right away was put together Windows of Hope, which got tremendous support around the country.
You know, the thing that I remember, and I'm sure those of us who were down there, here was this amazing restaurant. And so in the first few days, I swear to God, I'm like, where are the stoves? Or I thought I would see broken plates, bottles, silverware. It was, first of all, you didn't see file cabinets, and you didn't see...
No, only dust.
It was, everything was so pulverized. And mm-hmm. But then the mangled, it was like this unbelievable sculpture. And I mean, it was like nothing I've ever seen in my life or what I will ever see. And the photos obviously don't do it even justice. I mean, it's...
We have to take a little break, and we'll come back with more from Drew Napurant, Michael LaMonaco, and David Boulay. We're talking about what happened downtown in what was then a really hot restaurant area. In fact, Tribeca was a rather hot neighborhood, at least for a time. It was the place that people were going to after they decided they didn't want to stay in Soho anymore. I don't know whether Tribeca has been replaced by Williamsburg or some other place, but we can find out as we continue our conversation. Stay with us. We're back with Drew Napurant, the owner founder of the Myriad Restaurant Group, which operates Tribeca Grill, Nobu in New York City and London, Corton and Centrico. Michael LaMonaco, the executive chef partner of Porterhouse New York in the Time Warner Building, and David Boulay, chef at Boulay Restaurant, Boulay Bakery and Market, and Brushstroke. And they are all downtown. And we're talking about what happened to the downtown area on 9/11 and after. And I remember, Drew, how scared you and Karen Waltuck of the late lamented Chanterelle were about the survival of all the downtown restaurants. How many people were able to make it to your restaurants once the dust was swept away?
Well, that was the extraordinary thing, that 2 weeks we were all closed. And then when they finally actually opened the streets for pedestrian traffic, they didn't initially open the streets for vehicular. So, but still, you know, I remember Nathan Lane, you know, and actually he just came in the other night. Here's a guy, you know, I think the community in New York at large knew to come downtown and support the restaurants downtown, because here was this terrible victimization, and we didn't want any further economic victimization. What did the workers of any business downtown have to do with any of this? So there was a shining moment in our history, and unfortunately when...
So people were getting off at Canal Street?
Yeah, and they were doing... Oh, people were shuttling people down. I think I actually had I had a driver at the time, so I still have the same driver, by the way. But we had this big jalopy, and we would, like, shuttle people to Canal, and then they'd walk down. I mean, it was... Or, you know, get them out of town, too. But it was amazing. And then what really happened, unfortunately, was when George Bush decided to go to war with the wrong people. I mean, you could draw a line. That whole communal feeling just
downtown,
ended.
I think downtown became, you know, being uptown, having lost Windows and then having kind of relocated to uptown, and we were doing a lot of, organization things that were really Windows and those we lost. We were focused on that, but we were very aware of downtown and the need to support downtown. And I'm sitting between, you know, these two gentlemen, these two guys were the innovators in creating this dining downtown.
I think along with Chanterelle, maybe,
yeah.
And suddenly everybody wanted to be down.
That's right.
The truth is, Chanterelle actually in 1979 on Green and Grand in Soho was really what gave me the courage to do Montrachet in the first place. And then I was fortunate enough in 1983 is when I met David on a whirlwind tour on the West Coast to restaurants. The last restaurant I went to, David was with Hubert Keller at Sutter 500. Mm-hmm. Probably made me the best meal of my lifetime, and we stayed in touch, and we wound up opening Montrachet in 1985.
Going downtown became something, and
it became a destination area. Yeah. What happened with your restaurants, David? How soon it before you were able to open up for business and feel like you were returning to normal?
Yeah, we had so much support from people who were putting tractor-trailer trucks on the street. And so we got into a really high production of feeding those folks in what we call the green tarp. And then Red Cross came in, and they were turning everything into a business. And I was thinking about, I got to go back and figure out how to salvage my businesses, because we're even a little bit lower. And, you know, the frontier was there again. But slowly we went back, and like the other fellows are saying here, a lot of people came down to support the restaurants. A lot of people didn't want to go either, because it was a lit up, very bright area. Then that light conveyed a bad or emotional part of their work day or friends or family or whatever. So there were a lot of people that would come down, and a lot of people that were there weren't going back. But what's exciting today is to see where we are today. I think we've got an area of ground zero, the downtown Manhattan, with all the buildings going up. I think the neighborhood is so full of enthusiasm. I think that we've got really beautiful skyline coming into shape. I think the lower part of Manhattan is going to be best it's ever been. So from an evolutional point, you know, you burn the forest and it comes back once again. Stronger than ever.
Yep. But have you been hurt by the recession? First you were hurt by the fact that the whole neighborhood was abandoned for a while, and now you have an economic recession to deal with.
I think us downtown have been taking some bumps. You know, of course, in the last few years with Wall Street going through an identity crisis and things. But, you know, I think we were talking about that earlier. We're in a great place in terms of the entire country. We have an area of a wonderful city that's going to be growing with benefits that has never been there before.
It's never been an easy business. It's always had its challenges. But, you know, I just have to say, I mean, David Boulay is one of America's great chefs. And, you know, he is a destination in and of himself. So I think that he's very modest. And it's a tough business climate to operate a business. But, you know, he's very important no matter where he would be. But I think what I was leading to was I congratulate him. It's an amazing thing that he stayed, that he didn't say, you know what, for my food, for my cooking, I'm going to relocate. He stayed. And that's the New York spirit.
Yeah, I mean, and you did too, Drew.
Drew did.
I think the thing that people lose sight of is we were in that neighborhood when there was nothing there. We established something, and then 16 years later, is when 9/11 occurred. 16 years.
Right. We're but what had drawn you there in the first place? It had been
I could afford
the
rent.
Egg and butter market, hadn't it? It was really an area that where few people lived. You weren't that close to Wall Street.
No, Len, let me be as clear as possible. Because both David and I worked at places, you know, the Perigord, La Régence, and all the Midtown French restaurants. We opened Montrachet on a shoestring. Why? Because we could afford the rent. And I think
the same reason people are going to Brooklyn now?
Well, I don't think the rent is so cheap in Brooklyn anymore. The truth is, and it's really an untold story, you know, everyone's talking about the economics of why there are no jobs available. I can tell you this, and I said it even before the recession. I would have opened 25 more restaurants in New York if the rent was reasonable and fair. The untold story is that everything is, you know, our costs of doing business have gone up. Our regulation in terms of labor, we all got hit with these idiotic tip pooling lawsuits and things like that. But the one thing that skyrocketed is the real estate. And for us to get into business and to do business, that's the first business decision we have to make.
Well, you know, actually the restaurant business is such a core business to building a neighborhood that I think that when they were innovators and went into, you know, lower Manhattan, Tribeca, they were really courageous in doing that and building a business. But I just want to say that Windows on the World was also as expensive a piece of real estate as the Twin Towers were. That's why Joe Baum opened it, because the Port Authority was really trying to make the Twin Towers attractive, and Windows
on the
World.
So they gave him a slightly better rent.
He had a good deal, but the point was to activate the space and make it human. But restaurants are the thing.
Again from people in the business is that they open a restaurant in a place where, let's say, there were 10 failures before, so they get a good rent, and then they have a big success, and suddenly the landlord is asking them for such a when they have to renew their lease for such an increase that they can't afford to stay anymore, but it's hard to move on. So how do you deal with that?
I had to move out of the first restaurant for that reason. Everyone thought I was insane closing in 1996. You know, again, when Drew and I, we had worked in these restaurants, and we thought we could do a better job if we had less overhead. And we created a product that I don't think anyone could have done uptown at that time, at the value and price. And I think that downtown has always yielded that opportunity for folks to come down and have a value because of the overhead being so much lower. But in 1996, when I closed, they were tripling my rent. And everyone thought I should be institutionalized. Why would you close a restaurant with 3 years of 29 at a Zagat and 4 stars and waiting 3 months to get in? But like we were all talking, Drew and I were talking earlier, the luxury restaurant scene, all our overhead and cost are constantly increasing, but our price pretty much has stayed, I think, relatively the same for 25 years now.
Especially in comparison to other major cities like Paris, London,
absolutely.
Moscow.
Right.
You know,
What I was going to say about the World Trade Center is my father worked for the State Liquor Authority. So they couldn't lease out the World Trade Center. So they moved all the state offices into the World Trade Center. So I used to visit both. Actually, my uncle was with the Labor Relations Board. So I used to go to the World Trade Center to visit my uncle and my father at work. And the great thing, what Joe Baum and obviously Windows on the World did, was it did make that a destination.
Absolutely.
I mean, it was just so special to walk into those two buildings. And, you know, it was just the architecture. And
the food was
remember
good.
You had to swallow going
and,
up.
And food was unlike great. Some other places like Tavern on the Green, the food quality was always held to the highest
go easy
standard.
Now, Leonard, I worked
food
at Tavern.
Was great.
And then the food. Windows, what you had to say about Joe Baum was his ideas were always profound. Could he get everybody to live up to his ideas? That was a problem. When Michael became the chef, I think, you know, the food maybe improved dramatically because at the beginning it was hard to deal with the volume, I would think, the volume of
execution.
The restaurant.
Execution.
My guests are Drew Napora, Michael LaMonaco, and David Boulay. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. 10 years ago, we spoke with Bob Giraldi, who is a film and TV director, who was also a restaurateur downtown at the time, and we asked him what he thought would happen to the restaurant industry in light of the attacks, and here's what he had to say.
The smaller, simpler restaurants right now that don't have as high overhead as larger restaurants are better off, obviously. Simpler food is very important right now. I don't think Americans are interested in too much pomp and circumstance or celebration. So I think there's ways and restaurants that'll survive better than others, but that's the case in almost every business.
Well, he seems to have been a bad predictor.
He was right on the mark. Great insight.
I heard Michael say something which has been my lament for a long time. What's happened, Leonard, in the press? The press has fixated on the hamburger, the pizza, the meatball. And here, you know, the three of us collectively.
Well, the Shake Shack is doing very well.
There's the perfect item you can cook at home. This is the perfect item you can cook at home, and lazy people have to go out and eat at all these places. But it's all right. The point I guess I'm trying to make, though, is we get marginalized in the press when they don't talk about us. And I know that the three of us were pioneers in raising the bar. Mm-hmm. Both, you know, not just about the refinement of food. Keeping in mind, when we opened Morichet, we charged $16 for three courses. We were trying to pass on the savings. It cost me probably $16 now per customer in rent as an overhead number. Mm-hmm. So this is really the big problem with us being able to. You know, we stayed in Lower Manhattan for a reason. We had established something. Our reputations were down there. You got to give David a lot of credit for being able to move a business. You know, something like Boulay and recreating it not only once but twice. I mean, it's pretty amazing.
These days, do you think much about what you were going through 10 years ago, or have you moved past it?
Well,
Michael, you're uptown. You're running a very different kind of a restaurant.
Right.
And the only thing that's similar is that you're once again inside of a building. You're not on the street level.
Well, let me just say that, you know, it's had a certain connection that hasn't stopped, and I'm just going to go back to just quickly to Windows of Hope. What ultimately happened was is we raised $22 million for the families of the food service workers who were lost on that day, and we were able to really, and now we're looking back at the 10-year, at this 10-year point, and most of the money has been distributed to those families for whom the money was raised. And there's $4 million or so now earmarked for education. So we've really met a goal of emergency aid and things that we initially planned for in the first few years, and then scholarship and children's education, family education was the one of the primary focuses of the last 5 years. And it has been a constant in my life, this Windows of Hope. It's sort of anchored me to this date, this event, and not to mention all the loss and of the friends. So, you know, that aspect has stayed sort of, you know, true. But it is good to look back at 10 years and say, you know what, the industry got together and created this thing that was able to help, 150 families.
A listener in Chinatown says Chinatown still hasn't recovered nearly as well as other downtown communities. They were terribly hurt by all of the street closings and the barricades.
I don't know. I still go to Wo Hop.
Yeah. I think that one thing I remember was the collective support and everyone working together. There's so many people that since then have told me they met their husband or wife volunteering. And so many people left that period with such rewards that they remember and will maintain through their life.
So you think there's a sense of community that has developed in the Tribeca area?
I think the whole country, but particularly us downtown, we saw people work together that most people would never imagine they would be so strong and helping each other, and there was a very different atmosphere.
Do people still come up to you, cops, firefighters?
Firemen the other day told me, you know, you ruined my life. I went home after all that, and my wife made me dinner, and I looked up at her and I said, "What is that?" So we still hear from folks that are going through, and volunteers on a regular basis will talk about the energy that they all had.
Well, Drew, you've kind of created your own neighborhood down there anyway with all of the different restaurants you have and great successes. Nobu is an institution now, an international institution. Corton is one of the hottest restaurants in the city. Does it matter where you are?
Oh, yes, it does, actually. If I were going to be totally honest, it's much more harder right now to bring the people downtown than it was. First of all, when we created something in the 80s, we stood alone because we kind of were part of the development of that neighborhood. And really what happened after 9/11 was that people were very, very cognizant of supporting us. And then all that goodwill, Leonard, wiped away when we went to war in Iraq. I don't mean this in a negative way, but the 10 years don't feel at all like 10 years. And I'm not saying...
They feel like longer or shorter?
No, way shorter. It's remarkable. And in a good way, you know, where everyone was like, how come we can't rebuild these buildings quicker? Now, when we see the progress, when we see this beautiful memorial, I was in the 49th floor of Seven World looking down at it the other night. It was spectacular. So that washes over you really positively. Mm-hmm. But what I would say is the reason we're still in the game, this guy Boulay, myself, and LoMonaco here, is because we raised the bar 26 years ago, and we continue to work like that. We're not going to rest on our laurels. And we're not going to – you know, Michael's a different story, but as defining a moment as 9/11 was, it's like I can't let that define – you know, there were too many people who had impacted right. in a different way. Those are the people that you have to respect. But, you know, Michael, what's beautiful about Michael is the dignity and also the fact that they put their money where their mouth was. And there are families, their children are growing up without their parents, but they have education thanks to the Windows of Hope and other things that these people looked after.
Yeah, I think it's very honorable what you did, Michael.
No, it was the industry. It was really all of the restaurants that really made it happen, and the diners, you know, and the diners who supported. But you know, I couldn't go home again. You know, I couldn't. But this is my home. New York is my home, and restaurants are what I love and do. So it was always a matter of finding a place. We're now Porterhouse is in our fifth year, so that's a wonderful thing. But I'll tell you one thing that I noticed being. You know, displaced that way was that neighborhood dining really took off after a year or two. You really saw, you know, this very, you know, the neighborhood started to see development. And the one great thing in the restaurant business that has really been a trend the last 7-8 years is the single entrepreneur has been courageous in opening the little storefronts. And I have to say, the two gentlemen sitting here are really models for that kind of that business model.
I want to thank you all so much for being with us today. Michael LoMonaco is the executive chef and partner at Porterhouse New York. David Boulay is a chef at Boulay Restaurant, Boulay Bakery and Market, and Brushstroke. And Drew Naparant is the owner, founder of the Myriad Restaurant Group, which operates Tribeca Grill, Nobu, New York City, and London, Coton, and Centrico. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.